The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 294.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is The Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to The Rebel Capitalist Show. He is my good friend, and he hosts one of the best podcasts out there. As a matter of fact, if you're really a macro geek, I would suggest listening to their podcast prior to listening to my podcast. It's called Making Sense with Emil Kalinowski and Jeff Snyder. Emil, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, my friend.
It's a pleasure to be back, George. Really, I appreciate it. I'm excited to be back. The show that I do with Jeff has grown, and we're excited, and we're looking forward to new things. So every week we're doing a show, and the next one will be recorded Thursday and available Friday.
I'm really glad to hear that it's grown, because just that fact means that there's more and more people that have the opportunity to listen to your knowledge, your collective knowledge, and how you go back and forth with Jeff and really kind of expose, for lack of a better word, all of his understanding of not only markets, but financial history and the history of communism, the history of China, the history that pertains to the world events that we're seeing play out in front of our eyes today. So I'm sure we'll get into that in this conversation. But when you text me about the interview, you had some data that you thought would be very relevant and interesting for my audience. So let's go through that.
Sure. The Bank for International Settlements, the central banker's central bank, what they do is they put out a series of data sets that serve as early warning indicators for a banking crisis, not just a regular banking crisis, but they specifically call it a systemic banking crisis.
So this would be the difference. G-SIBs, Emil? You know?
What are G-SIBs? Remind me.
Remember, that was that acronym they're using a lot, I think, just prior to the Cerveza sickness, we'll call it, is globally systemic important right. banks, or globally systemic international banks, something like that.
It's more than that, right? Because there's several flavors of banking crisis, right? There could be a G-SIB crisis, like, say, Northern Rock, and that's just a bank run 2007 affects that bank. And then you could have multiple banks affected by something like the savings and loan crisis in the late 80s. But they're saying, no, this is systemic, as in there's a crisis in the banking system that will spill over the sandbags that we've arranged trying to keep this contained in the financial system. It will spill over and wash out through the rest of the economy. So that's what they're talking about. They're talking about, you know, national economies, recessions, big trouble.
Yeah. And taking that one step further, looking at through the lens of the euro dollar market, if those banks have issues, that means there's a global dollar liquidity issue that would go along with it. And that's just fancy words for saying that the dollars that these national corporations need to fund themselves overnight and weekly and monthly, because a lot of their assets are illiquid, those dollars would not be available. And that's what happened to Lehman Brothers. You know, they had assets. They had to mark them to market, which I think is one reason why Jeff would say that we had the GFC in the first place. But then they went to try to access repo just to get the liquidity they needed to function. And the repo market basically gave them the bird. And that's right. The rest is history.
I would describe these early warning indicators as getting over your ski tips kind of indicators. So they're saying it's okay if you're extending credit in your system, in your country. That's fine, even if it seems like a lot relative to other countries. What they're warning about, what we saw with Lehman Brothers in 2008, is that you got way ahead of yourself relative to your trend. So they offer these five different measures, and I think each one of them is relative to your national trend. So if you're crazy, but you've gotten used to crazy, And hasn't that happened in so many different ways in the last 14 years? We've gotten used to things that we would look back on. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, we would say, that's insane. But we've gotten used to it. Well, yeah, these indicators.
You know what that reminds me? I'm sorry to cut you off there, Emil, yes. But you know what that reminds me of? I was listening to Jim Grant's podcast this morning. And I guess he's coming out with some of his t-shirts. You know how he does those really cool cartoons? I'm sure you can appreciate that. And I guess he's got one of the Federal Reserve. And there's this person shouting from the Federal Reserve, what comes after a trillion? Illustrates exactly what you're talking about.
Love it. Well, that's the idea. Yeah. So these are, hey, you're crazy, but that's okay. But if you are out crazying what you've gotten used to, that means it's just gotten too far ahead. And because, you know, it just can't last forever. They're saying there's a good chance. In fact, they put a number on it. They say there's a 50% chance within 3 years that you'll have a banking crisis if you trip these thresholds.
Wow. Plus
these five indicators.
So do you have the thresholds?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I can go over of them, each right? of them. There's yeah, five of them.
Let's do it.
Just to set the context, the regular run-of-the-mill country in any random year since the Second World War, the chance of a financial crisis is 7%, right? You just bad luck, you have a financial crisis. But the BIS says you trip any one of these five, you got a 50% chance. So your chances go up tremendously.
Okay.
Oh, and here's the punchline, George. There's 15 countries that have tripped at least two or more of these early warning indicators since December 2018. And I picked that quarter because, you know, we want that three-year window. So by the end of this year and the first quarter thereafter, that's how the BIS says, as soon as the 3 years is up, the zero quarter is the 13th quarter. That's when you would have a, you know, 50-50 chance of
every quarter that goes on that we don't get that crisis, is it safe to assume the probabilities of the crisis increase?
Not necessarily. It depends on the measure.
Right.
Some of the measures actually lose predictability right when you approach the crisis. It doesn't. And then some measures keep rising into and past the crisis, like cross-border claims. If I remember, international investment into a country continues even after the crisis has started.
Okay, great. So let's go over the five for the listeners and viewers.
And then eventually we'll come up with a list of a dirty dozen. Actually, it's a filthy 15 of countries that have tripped two of these. And there's one country at the top of the list that has tripped four out of five. And I don't know, I'll buy somebody, you know, I'll send one of these illustrations by David Parkins if they can guess what it is before.
Oh, I think I might know, but I'm not going to let the cat out of the bag. I'll wait till the end here.
It's surprising. All right. So,
okay, well, then maybe I don't know.
Well, no. I mean, it's surprising because it's everyone's favorite country if you don't count, you know, all the Scandinavian countries and New Zealand and so on. But
all right. I don't want to give away too much here.
All right. So okay. Well, let's just go over the five. Let's see here. The first one is the credit to GDP gap. And what does that mean? That's a bunch of fancy words. And basically means if you have credit relative to your GDP and it accelerates well beyond your national trend and it goes beyond the threshold, then that's a signal of a early warning indicator, then you've got 3 year countdown and a 50-50% chance.
So would this be the credit that the bank is extending? So the assets on their balance sheet or the liabilities in the form of debt they have that they owe other people?
This is on the whole national system. Great question. I didn't mention this. This represents not the banks. It's not the banks.
Oh, okay.
It's
okay.
The private system. Okay. So it's all of the households and all of the non-financial corporations.
Okay, so
all of the businesses. Exactly.
Got it.
You add everything up and you calculate how much, you know, credit, debt are they into.
Okay.
Relative to GDP, you compare it to the long run trend and you say, if you're over your threshold, then you've got a chance.
Okay, got it.
number one on the on this. So here are the countries that triggered this: Hong Kong, Japan, Canada, South Korea, Norway, Sweden, France, China, Switzerland, Chile, Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand.
Was Australia on there?
It was not.
That surprises me with their housing market.
Very interesting. Great point. And it goes back to they're used to they're crazy. They're not above their crazy trend.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Everything keeps going up. It's been going up for a generation. Therefore, it'll continue to keep going up. Okay. Like in China, you know, and how they tripped the credit gap for the private sector, but they did not trip the residential property warning indicator. Canada didn't. Australia didn't. China didn't. Can you believe it? On residential property?
Because it's a measurement of how fast it's accelerating, not necessarily the nominal difference or the delta.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
Okay, got it. So then what's number two?
All right. Credit. The next one.
Gap.
Total debt service ratio. So again, we're talking about the private economy, households, non-financial corporations. How much interest, how much debt amortization, you know, principal they're repaying relative to the income that you're making.
Got it. Got it.
And again, if you go a little bit too far, you've got the countdown going. Let's see.
But is this something that's measured by an acceleration or just the nominal delta? You see what I'm saying? Is it like number one? Or is it, I would assume it's like number one if they're using that measurement.
Yes, it's compared to the 20-year rolling average.
Yeah, okay.
So if you are, I don't know how many percentage points all over that ratio, the between the two ratios, then you trigger it. Let's see, who have we got here again? Canada, the Czech Republic, South Korea, Norway, Sweden, Hong Kong, France, China, Russia, Switzerland. So we've heard a couple of countries being mentioned twice already.
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with real estate as well.
They have a separate measure. That's coming up. That's okay. Coming up for okay, real cool. estate. But maybe. Then they've got one where you just focus on households. So this is our third measure. Right now we did households and businesses. This one is just households.
Okay.
You don't have very many countries here. No. But you've only got four that have tripped the early warning indicator since December 2018. Canada, South Korea, Norway, and Sweden, where the households relative to income are really experiencing a lot of interest payments relative to what they've gotten used to being able to afford.
Right, right.
Let's go to cross-border claims before we go to residential property.
Okay.
So cross-border claims is the fancy way of saying foreign investment, hot flows, capital flows coming into your country. I think we're used to the idea of foreign denominated debt, right? So you've got to repay dollars. You're an emerging market. You're too far in on your dollar debt. They looked at that and they said it was not as predictive as the whole picture. So it can include local denominated debt that's being, you know, sourced to you from abroad. The key is how much money is coming in from abroad into the whole system, into the banks and households, if there are any, but I doubt it. And then what else? Corporations.
Okay.
And that then filters out through the rest of the economy. And if there's too much relative to GDP, the concern is what you're going to have is you're going to have a bubble that is, you know, it first finds all the productive investments that you can, just like in the, you know, Asian financial crisis, right? You find all the foreign direct investment, all the productive stuff. And then eventually you run out of productive investment. So you start making things that may not make sense, like that the tower in Malaysia. Remember the Kuala Lumpur, the tallest building at the time? Maybe that wasn't the right thing.
I think the same thing happened with Dubai too. That kind of marked the top in the real estate market. So basically they just go further and further out the risk curve until the bubble pops.
Until you're investing in things that don't make any sense.
Right.
And especially relative to your GDP, right? If they've got so much money coming in, but your gigantic country, China, maybe, you know, it's not going to trip anything. But if you're a smaller country, or if there's a gigantic amount of money coming in, you know, you got to measure it relative to GDP. And then what they do is they say, okay, we're at this level. Where were we 3 years ago? And if you see, I think it was 35% increase relative to where you were 3 years ago, you trip your early warning indicator.
Got it.
We've got one left, George, one left. This one's right in your wheelhouse. Residential property prices. Residential property prices. And this one is systemic because it encompasses the economy, right? It's pervasive. If there's a bubble in real estate, you would think it's affecting everything. Whereas like the late 90s, right? We had a technology bubble in the United States, but it didn't affect the whole country. We recently had the Bitcoin bubble that didn't affect the whole country. Residential is like the railroad bubbles of the 19th century, right? It's all encompassing, systemic. And if there's a bubble here, the BIS says that this indicator is special. It's more equal on this animal farm than the other indicators. And they say, if you've got a problem in residential property, it's likely systemic and it's affecting these other things. And what they said is it lowers the threshold for those four other indicators. So if you've got this, you don't have to reach the high indicator on a standalone cross-border claims or debt service ratio. So this is the one that's key.
And this is residential prices to incomes.
Residential prices, real prices. So they're inflation adjusted. Okay. And the key is not to income, but to your long run history. So again, Canada, nuts. China, nuts. Australia, nuts. Guess what? None of them tripped the early warning indicator.
Because it's been normal. Nuts forever.
Yes, normal. Let's see.
So I guess that kind of makes sense from their standpoint, because you figure if the country's been, this is not me talking. I would not make this argument. But their argument is probably, well, if Canada's been able to kind of incorporate this risk into their economy for the past 30 years, then there's a lower probability that it becomes a problem in the future because of the evolutionary or adaptive process of the economy itself. But it makes sense that this is such a strong indicator for the other four as well, because if you think about real estate prices, that's in most countries, that's the majority of people's net worth. And so if that net worth increases, then that's going to affect spending positively or negatively. And then one man's spending is another man's income. And so if you have real estate prices go down significantly and stay down, then that's going to really impact spending. And if you're in a country that is overwhelmed with debt at a sovereign level, at a corporate level, at an individual level, then it's going to be very, very difficult to pay back those debts. Then you have this deflationary implosion, the bad type of deflation, not the good type.
If you want to have a systemic crisis, you need to find an industry that is systemic, that can represent the whole nation. Right. And residential property is one of those few that encompasses the entire nation for exactly the reasons that you described right there.
You know, my concern, Emil, is that with the United States, we've seen that phenomenon in the past. But I, just through my research, I'm under the opinion that now it's not just real estate. I think it's the stock market as well. Because those same negative consequences that we just discussed with real estate, if you can envision a future in the United States where the stock market goes down by 50 or 60% and stays there for a decade, very similar to what happened in Japan, I think those same systemic negative effects would apply if the stock market goes down, just like they'd apply if the real estate market goes down.
You are absolutely right, George. You're not even an academic, but guess what? You've nailed what these Harvard economists wrote in this paper. This one is called, for the audience that want to read this, Predictable Financial Crises, and it's by Robin Greenwood, Samuel G. Hansen, Andre Schleifer, Jacob Am Sorensen. And that's exactly what they find. They did the same thing as the BIS, except they went back further in time, all the way to World War II and forward. And they looked at the stock market as well as residential property prices. And just what you said, they said the stock market is also key if you combine it with another debt measure. So does the stock market way ahead of itself? And is residential household debt way ahead of itself? And if you've got those two things, you trigger an early warning indicator and you've got 3 years again. And their measure says the 40% probability.
Yeah.
So, yes.
And now Bingo. We've gotten to the point in the United States where the tax revenue coming into the federal government is really predicated upon the stock market as well. People like AOC and Elizabeth Warren and all these types, they like to believe or convince you that if we just jack the rates up to 90% on the rich, then all our problems would be solved. Just look at the 1950s. But what they fail to tell you is that when you actually look at tax receipts relative to GDP, going all the way back to the 1940s, regardless of whether the highest marginal rate is 90% or 25%, we still get about 18% tax revenue to GDP, regardless of what those rates are. So what makes it go up and down is usually when we have a big stock market crash or the stock market's at all-time highs or really booming, like an example that would be the late 1990s or the GFC tax receipts just completely plummeted. And in a government that's already running $5 trillion deficits, and those deficits will most likely expand, that could be a big problem.
I think I've been remiss in sort of ignoring the stock market's potential for socioeconomic volatility and crises, because I was under the impression that not as many people are invested, right? As in the late 90s, it was almost 50% or just over 50% of the United States had some sort of investment in the stock market. So yes, if it goes down, yes, everyone will be affected. And I thought that number had dropped quite a bit lower, but to your point, and this study, it is important. I haven't been looking into it, but I should.
I think even if the percentage of the aggregate total has gone down, the overall dependency has gone up, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. Like mm-hmm. if it was 50% before, well, out of those 50%, how many people were solely reliant on that purchasing power moving forward, or that purchasing power increasing in order for them to retire, as an example, or that purchasing power in order for them not to have to go back to work? See, maybe I would argue that I would argue that a smaller percentage back in the 1950s or 60s would be as reliant on their stock portfolio than the same percentage is today, if that makes sense.
It does. I'm going to look into it more closely as soon as our call is over.
Yeah, Emil, let's go back to these five indicators you were talking
yes.
about, because pretty much at the core of each one of these is a non-bank entity getting over its skis, to your point, as far as the amount of debt that it's taking on relative to how much cash flow it has to service the debt. And you and Jeff always talk about the future being disinflationary, the probabilities of the future being inflationary, disinflationary, or maybe even at some point deflationary. And I know it's a very nuanced conversation, but correct me if I'm wrong, the thrust of the argument is really that the commercial banks create the majority of dollars in our system. I talked to Richard Werner the other day. He was pegged at about 97% of the dollars, the new dollars that are created by the commercial banking system. Now, let's forget about the fact that the Fed's monetizing and all that stuff, but usually that's what happens. So if everyone in the economy that the banks can lend to is completely levered up, then there aren't going to be any more loans because the balance sheet of the private sector just can't handle any more debt relative to the income that the economy is producing. And therefore, who are the banks going to lend to? And if they can't lend to anyone, then there's no more dollars being created. There are only loans being paid off and therefore dollars being destroyed, which is a huge, huge, huge tailwind to deflationary pressures and a headwind to inflationary pressures. Do I have the argument right?
Yes, you do. But I think we can give credit to bankers to finding a way to lend more. Let's say they're lending and asset prices are going up. And this is the best example is residential property prices. You can put that up as collateral. And if your residential property prices keep going up in value, you can keep borrowing more. And also you can invest abroad, right? So we're talking about nations and maybe this particular nation is not interested, but the banks in that system can send money, cross-border claims, international lending, and go overboard, go too much in one particular direction. I'm thinking of New Zealand, everyone's favorite country right now. They just tripped in the cross-border claims early warning indicator. They also tripped their residential property price indicator. So I think the foreign claims started coming in 18 months ago or so, like they went overboard. Maybe it was because everyone loved what their prime minister was doing. I don't know, but money started pouring in there, maybe from the Chinese, you know, I don't know. It was coming in. And then just recently for March 2021, that's as far as this data goes through, by the way, they triggered their residential property price indicator. Maybe that foreign money had come in and jacked up the prices, whereas internally the banks would not have gone as far, maybe.
Yeah. So what's your view right now on the inflation that we've seen in 2020 or here in 2021 being transitory or more permanent?
Well, this is something that Jeff and I discuss often on our show.
Yeah, we get Jeff's view, but your view, maybe you've got something a little different to say.
I feel that the inflation is not monetary, as Jeff says, that it's supply chain and logistics cost.
Okay.
And you may think, so what? Is it a distinction without a difference? It is a distinction without a difference if wages aren't rising, which they haven't been, right? The Atlanta Fed has a labor wage tracker, which I recommend everyone check out. It doesn't look good. It doesn't look good at all. So if inflation in goods is accelerating from logistical disruptions and it's outpacing wages, that's very bad.
So wages are one of the key indicators you guys are looking at?
No, I was saying, I believe the logistical disruptions are the cause of the price increases, supply imbalances, demand surges.
Okay.
I believe that's what's causing the disruption and price increases. And I wanted to make the point and acknowledge to everyone that I'm not dismissing it as not being monetary inflation. Therefore, we don't have to worry about it because wages are not keeping pace. So for, you know, real life, when you go to the grocery store, you're not happy. You're not happy. And I acknowledge that.
Yeah. And I want to be clear, Emil, let me be clear just for the audience, because they may be saying right now, Emil, what are you talking about? Wages are going up. I mean, I see McDonald's paying $15 an hour, blah, blah, blah. But here's my point is even if wages are going up, the point is prices are going up even faster. So let's just say that everyone's making $15 an hour at minimum wage. The prices of the stuff you buy at the grocery store has gone up even more. And that's why people's purchasing power is really getting squeezed.
In the United States, go to the Atlanta Fed labor wage tracker, and you can go back in time. And what you see is that, yes, it's always positive. It's never negative, right? Wages are always growing, but it's growing slower and slower and slower. And it traces out a pattern, for those of you who have this in mind, of the labor force participation rate. in the early 2000s, it crested, went down, kept going down. It hit some kind of a little bit of a rebound as we headed into the great financial crisis. Then it went down even further, a little bit of a recovery, but never got back to that 2008 level. And then now again, much lower. So the rate of growth is pathetic in wages. And therefore, these price increases are having an impact. But the point we make is, how do we resolve these issues? Who do we complain to? Who do we look to as being the problem? Is the Federal Reserve the problem for these wage, for these price increases? No. What the problem is the logistical and supply chain disruptions. That's what we need to look to. Or even, yeah, the government spending is the government.
Because people will say, oh, it's a result of, we'll call it the cerveza sickness.
Oh, yeah.
And I say, no, it's a result of the government's response to the cerveza sickness. Let's be clear.
Agreed. Yes.
So I agree. Let's go back here. We're talking about this being a monetary phenomenon. And I think a lot of the viewers and listeners would say, okay, Emil, how can you argue this isn't a monetary phenomenon when we've seen M2 money supply go up by, call it 25% in 2020 or the trailing 12 months or something like that. But you guys talk about this all the time on your podcast, which is another reason why people really need to listen to every episode of Making Sense. But M2 money supply, I know Jeff would just completely laugh it off, but it's not very accurate. If we have a pie chart, as an example, M2 money supply would maybe only tell us what's happening with 25% of the pie, where there's another 75%, and maybe these numbers aren't accurate, I'm just using them as an example, but there's another 75% of the pie that is in the shadows. It's out of the purview of the Fed. They don't know these dollars exist. They might know they exist, but they definitely cannot quantify them because they are just on the balance sheets of banks, bank entities that just have accounts with one another. I was calling them the ghost ledger the other day. And then banks outside of the United States and private entities outside the United States that have all of these dollars and have the ability to create dollar-denominated credit and therefore take on dollar-denominated debt. So if that's at 75% and that goes down by, let's say, 5%, but yet M2 money supply goes up by 10%, but it only represents 25% of the pie chart, then on net balance, the amount of dollars has actually gone down. So am I getting that idea correct or that concept?
The analogy I love to use is of dark energy and dark matter, right? M2, when we look up into the sky, are those pinpricks of light. That's what we see. We see the planets, the gases, the stars. That's what we see.
Right.
But if we think about it, what we really see, the overwhelming view is of darkness, dark energy, dark matter in physics. In money, it's the same thing. It's money in the shadows. And recently, I started doing a macro piece theater reading style podcast. So in addition to the Jeff Show, which we do every week, I've started reading interesting works by macroeconomists, geopolitical thinkers, whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, I was listening to the gym the other day.
Yeah.
You did.
Thank
one,
you very much.
Yeah, keep going. I'm going to pull up this one that I suggest people listen to the whole thing. But there was one in particular that I really found fascinating. And I remember I was at the gym and I was just sitting there talking to Kiyosaki and telling, I think I was talking to him about this. It's your room, Jeff Snyder. Is it?
So Kiyosaki and Gammon are sitting in the sauna. They're in their towels.
No. He's talking going into about a spin class. He always goes to this spin class. And I was out doing a real man's workout, lifting weights. You know, we'll let Kiyosaki do the girly stuff.
Look at you getting your pump on. Let's make that a live Q&A session.
Well, I'm not seeing it here. It was Mirakan or.
Yes.
Mirmikin.
Daniel Oliver, financial historian.
Oh, yeah.
I love the way he writes. And his work is fantastic. So yes.
Go ahead.
The reason I bring it up is because today, episode 111 is my reading of Jeff's presentation at the George Gammon Spectacular Festivus Rebel Capitalist Live Show, where he talked exactly about your question, M1, M2, yeah, and much more, and ghost money and the Eurodollar, and how Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies are a repeat of human ingenuity in the face of monetary disorder, monetary shortage. It's no wonder cryptocurrencies came about, just how the Eurodollar came about to solve Triffin's paradox, and how ghost ledgers came about to solve the great bullion famine of the 15th century. So that was exactly what Jeff presented. And to your point, yes, M2 through the roof. That's what we see. What we don't see are the bank balance sheets that really fund the global economy, and they've been stagnant, suffering for 14 years. That's the money that powers the global economy, and it's not really expanding.
Yeah. In your guys' conversation, could you shed some light, or just using your guys' conversations as a framework, can you shed some light on what has happened with the reverse repo, with the Fed being the counterparty, and how these money market funds have taken, I don't know where it is now, what is over a trillion. It's like a trillion.
I stopped counting at a trillion.
Something like that. It's like Jim Grant's t-shirt, you know, what comes after a trillion. But through those conversations you've had, Jeff, can you explain how you guys see that, and what the reasons for that are?
There are two reasons. A, the publicly accepted narrative that the money market funds have a surplus of deposits, and they might as well put it with the Federal Reserve, which is offering them 5 basis points. That's better than a stick in the eye, or 0 basis points, which is the going rate everywhere else. Okay, that's the mainstream narrative. Surely there's some of that taking place, maybe even a lot of that. But what the reverse repo also does, Jeff often mentions, is what you get in return is the collateral. And so he says what's happening is, yes, putting your money somewhere where you can earn some return, but also you're in desperate need of that collateral, very likely. And you think, well, why? Why? Because the surges and the percolations in this reverse repo program, they didn't just happen on any random days. They happened to start right when something was going wrong in the monetary shadows that we can observe in other measures. So it's no coincidence.
I.e. Janet Yellen selling fewer T-bills.
Yes,
or that collateral. Right.
Fedwire going belly up for a few hours on the 24th of February. It was turned off. You know, that's how banks are sending money to each other and making sure that there's no intraday overdrafts. So they know how much they're going to owe at the end of the day. All of a sudden, it went dark. We don't know why, for a few hours. And you can see that date on the reverse repo chart. You shouldn't. It was nothing. February 24th, and then another several other days that coincide with monetary disturbances. So Jeff's point is, yeah, this, the publicly accepted narrative, but also there's disorder, there's trouble.
So what is the monetary disturbance that is causing this more permanent use of reverse repo when the Fed's the counterparty? Any idea?
Risk appetite, you know, not believing in the reflation and the recovery, that the economy can be turned on and off and then go back to whatever normal was. Normal stunk, by the way.
Yeah.
So we're going to go back to normal. That wasn't too good. Or are we even going to get back to normal? Right. So we've had this Delta COVID's lockdown again. So maybe the case counts have peaked there and we're having another reflation. But for a long time, it was, we're not getting back to normal. Normal wasn't any good. And so I think it was risk perceptions. Why extend loans to small mom and pop shops or anything other than the safest, most liquid borrowers? Why invest in the real economy? Why speculate in anything like that? And so you would see kind of a withdrawing. And to your point earlier about that M2 and that inverted pyramid, when there's not enough money coming into the system, the whole inverted pyramid becomes more fragile, that it can tip over because everyone is investing long but borrowing short. That's, you know, the whole banking system. And that's what, you know, that's what I was coming on to talk about the banking crises, potential ones.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Yeah, that's the conclusion I came to that I went over in a lot of my whiteboard videos, is it wasn't about the money market funds just being flushed with cash. And, you know, maybe that was it on the margin, but I thought it was had to do more with counterparty risk. Because, you know, these money market funds, they have to ask themselves, who, my dollars are a liability of whom? So if they have their dollars parked at the Fed, I hate to use that term because they're not really parked at the Fed, you know, if those bank reserves are going down into that reverse repo account, let's say, now all of a sudden their dollars that are assets on their balance sheet are now liabilities of the Fed. And though the Fed can print those bank reserves that are denominated in dollars. I don't like to call them dollars because as you know well, they're a lot different than the dollars that circulate in the real economy. But if those money market funds are taking that $1.4 trillion and not putting them at the Fed, then those dollars that are assets on their balance sheets are most likely liabilities of the commercial banking system. So I think that's your point, is if they're sniffing out something that's problematic with the commercial banking system, like, listen, we don't want our dollars as a liability of Wells Fargo or Bank of America. We'd prefer that we take as little risk as possible, and we want our dollars to be liabilities of the Federal Reserve.
Exactly. I don't know what they're thinking, but what we're seeing is a collective decision to take less risk. And in the middle of a supposedly super accommodative monetary policy cycle. So that's what we were seeing throughout this year, since late February until, let's say, mid early August.
Yeah, but the BIS stuff that you've mentioned, that would back up that hypothesis.
Right? This,
because if the BIS is coming out and saying, listen, in these countries, the banks are, or the economies, and therefore the banks, there's a high probability that we could have a huge crisis here. And if we're living in a world that's globally connected, where the monetary system is globally connected, because 50 or 60% of the transactions are done in dollars. And therefore a lot of that dollar liquidity that they need is coming from US repo and from the euro dollar system outside of the United States. And I'm sure those money market funds have something to do with that, you know, not just domestic repo. And then if the BIS is saying there's all this systemic risk around the world with these huge countries, it's not like they're talking about Ecuador and you know, Pakistan. They're talking about some very, very large economies. Maybe that's what those money market fund managers are looking at, and saying, you know what, we don't want to be any part of that system as far as them, our dollars being their liability.
The global risk is ticking up.
Yeah.
If you like do a weighted average of all these measures, you will see that we are higher than we have been recently. So yes, it's ticking up. Can I read the 15 countries in reverse order?
Yeah, let's do that.
Do the big reveal. to your point, because you said it's not Ecuador, right? Okay, these are countries that have tripped at least two of those five early warning indicators. New Zealand, Germany,
so is New Brazil. Zealand 15?
No.
Or is it?
They've only tripped two.
Is it in order of how bad they are, or like?
I'm going in reverse order. Reverse. Okay. So from worst.
Number one is the worst country.
Yes.
Okay, got it.
Yes. All right. So these guys are all tied for third because they've only tripped two. Well, that's some of them are tripping them every quarter, whereas like New Zealand's only tripped two recent quarters. All right. So New Zealand, Germany. Wow. Germany has tripped cross-border claims and the credit gap. So too much debt and too much foreign money is coming in to Germany. Brazil, Slovak Republic, Chile, Switzerland. Switzerland and Hong Kong are both on here. Maybe it's not fair to include them because the debt that's in that country is not being serviced by that country, right? They're an advanced economy money center. So they're holding debts from around the world.
Right.
All right. But Russia, China, France, and Hong Kong, they've all tripped too. Now we're going to step up a level. These countries have tripped three of the five indicators: Sweden, North Korea, South Korea, and the Czech Republic. I think we've heard from South Korea about 3 weeks ago when they raised rates. They said, we're doing it to prevent financial crisis. So they know that things are a little bit dicey over there.
Right.
And now, the big reveal, the moment that everyone's been waiting for, the country that has tripped four of the five indicators, is everyone's favorite country, Canada. Amazing. Amazing. The only one they didn't trip is the residential property price,
which
is it's crazy, but they're really used to it.
Tripped it. I mean, let's be honest. For anyone who's looking,
I know what you mean.
A bit of common sense to say, yeah, they tripped that one a long, long, long time ago. So they're not out of the woods yet. That's for sure. Yeah. When you were reading that, what popped in my mind was Evergrande. And if the Chinese government allows them to fail, maybe that's their way of, reducing the amount of overall debt in the system and maybe taking control of their real estate market because they see these warnings from the BIS or maybe their internal economists.
I just read a paper by Mr. Russell Napier, financial historian, that talked exactly about that. And he said that there's five different ways of reducing your debt: growth, austerity, default, hyperinflation, or financial repression, which is very slow inflation and keeping rates here and inflation there and
negative real rate. Yeah.
And he said, maybe what Beijing is doing here with Evergrande is trying to reduce their debts by assigning those costs to capitalists, whether internal or external. We'll call them enemies of Xi Jinping or vested interests or, other power centers. But Napier said, you know what? Yeah, maybe. But that has not succeeded going through the default austerity deflationary path anywhere for long. It is very painful, very painful. So if they do pursue this defaulting deflationary wipeout, it is going to lead to socioeconomic and eventually political upheaval. So his point was that maybe for a little bit of time, but eventually Xi Jinping will be forced to change course and pursue financial repression. Which he has forecast for all the advanced economies, essentially. So it's not just China.
Yeah.
That financial repression is coming to an advanced economy near you.
Yeah. And he's also talked about combining that with price controls.
Basically,
capital control. Just the 1970s. Economies or the governments, I should say, or the central bankers actually doing that intentionally.
Just like they did in the 40s, 50s, 60s. And 70s until finally had gone too far. And we had the Thatcher and Reagan revolutions because it had gone on too far.
Yeah.
But it was a useful policy at the end of the Second World so as to inflate away these terribly towering debts that all these governments had accumulated. So it made sense at the time. And maybe it makes sense now because we have two dark towers of debt, public and private.
You know what the problem with that, though, is, Emil, is if you're, you know, when I was an entrepreneur, I would compartmentalize my costs into two buckets, recurring and non-recurring. And going back to World War II, those were non-recurring costs, assuming we weren't going to be in a perpetual world war for the next 5 decades, right? Most of the costs that we have now are recurring. So to take it down to a business level, you know, what we were paying for during World War II was the equivalent of marketing costs, right? Where you're launching a product, so you're going to spend an extra $50,000 a month on marketing. But when you get done marketing that product, you don't have that $50,000 expense. What we're doing now is not the equivalent of marketing cost, but it's the equivalent of your rent or payroll, where that cost is not going away. So I think that's a big difference. What do you think?
Are you referring to benefits? That those are the recurring costs.
Yeah, the government, Social Security, absolutely, welfare. We've got all these things that you know, that we've made commitments to these people, and we can't just stop paying. I guess we could just stop paying them, but it would just impact. Not only would we break our promises, not only would that, who knows what that would do to the bond market and the treasuries, and therefore pension funds and the sovereign wealth funds that you know, depend on these treasuries. I mean, there's a lot of systemic risks there. You know, we have to make these payments over and over, and we have to continue to make these payments indefinitely into the future if we're going to keep our promises. We're back in World War II, you know, yeah, debt to GDP got up to 120%, but all those costs for World War II, let's say that we had in 1943, we didn't have those in 1950. That's my point.
You're absolutely right. But guess what? We've got 5 options, and the best one would be growth. And we've right. been trying that since 2008, and it hasn't worked. Another one, austerity. Well, those people get voted out of office,
right.
you know, proposing austerity on any sort of spending. So we've got 3 options left. And by the way, why do we have to do this? You were talking about public debt. Public debt, as we learned from Rogoff, what was Reinhardt, that? Carmen Reinhart. Yeah. Public debt, if there's too much, what are the consequences? Slower economic growth.
Yeah.
You know, like Japan, I guess that's not bad. You know, just less acceleration in growth.
Well, you have a negative multiplier. Okay. Lacey Hunt points out you got a negative multiplier on government spending.
And that's the point where we are with public debt. But guess what? Private debt has been surging and is now at all-time human history highs. Right. And it's the private debt, as I learned in this delightful book, A Brief History of Doom by Richard Veith. George, if you're ever depressed.
It sounds like one of my whiteboard videos.
Yeah. Well, if you're ever depressed, if you ever need a pick-me-up, I want you to read A Brief History of Doom. It's delightful. Great book. The point being, it's private debt that tips over. It's a teetering tower of debt. And that's what leads to financial crises and socioeconomic ruin. So while we could sort of ignore the public debt thing and just live in a slower growth world, we now have the highest levels ever in private debt. And as I was talking about with the BIS, chances are these things are going to tip over. They always have before. That leads to socioeconomic consequences. And that's what will force governments to address the debt levels finally. And they don't have very many options. And the options that remain to us are bad news for savers and entrepreneurs.
Yeah, right. Let's go back to China here momentarily, because you guys talk about a topic regarding China that I never have heard anybody talk about before. And I've actually adopted it. Whenever I talk about it, I try to give you guys credit. And in fact, I used it in a whiteboard video, I think just last week. And it's this concept that when Deng Xiaoping took over in China in 1976, he looked around, and I got this from Warner. He looked around and saw what was happening in Germany and in Japan and said, okay, we want to move forward with capitalism. because we don't want to replicate the Russian experience, then we need to create some smaller banks. So he does that, creates community banks, and therefore you have this, we'll call it a capitalist revolution, for lack of a better word, in China. But then he sees Russia collapse in 1991, and he says, okay, well, that's our buddy, that's our trading partner. We were kind of replicating their economic model, or they were replicating ours. And if it collapsed, I need to know why. So he sent some economists into Russia to figure out what went wrong. Their conclusion was not that communists or communism failed. It's that they had implemented communism prior to allowing capitalism to run its course. And therefore, the Chinese need to continue to allow capitalism to run its course. And I think, and I don't want to put words in Jeff's mouth, but I think he would, or his conclusion is that Xi Jinping now sees China as in this phase of late stage capitalism, where the socialists or the revolutionaries have to come in and take over the means of production in order to move society forward. Because if they don't, then the capitalists are just going to feed on one another, and they're going to bring the whole system down, and they're going to reverse course and go back to a standard of living that was equivalent to something like feudalism, if the capitalists have their way. So they need to
rob the country.
Yeah. So that's the message that I got from listening to so many of your guys' interviews. I think it's fascinating, and nobody is talking about this. So can you shed some light on that?
Maybe no one's talking about it because they're not reading their Karl Marx anymore. Come on, what are you guys reading out there? You're not reading your Communist Manifesto? Come on. But it comes from Marx. Specifically, he said, what we need to do, we can't go straight to communism, where money and wealth is redistributed, enough money, and so as to maintain conditions. Because we're in a serfdom right now, we're a peasantry. What we need to do is do what the capitalists do fabulously. Take money, put it to work, create things. George Gammon, entrepreneur, create wealth that didn't exist before. People put people to work, create new goods. And then for some reason, this is the part I don't understand. He believed that eventually this runs out. Like human ingenuity stops. Like there's a limit to it. There's a limit to how high humanity can reach, you know? And that part just doesn't sit well with me. But here's the disturbing part. Guess what? Capitalism does end up in cul-de-sacs, depressions, global depressions. And he wrote it in 1848, the Communist Manifesto, which was the year after a surge of revolutions had swept across Europe and created socioeconomic chaos. So you could see it then. And then, of course, we had the Long Depression in the 19th century. Capitalism failed. The Great Depression in the 20th century, capitalism failed. That's when socialism took off, right? Maybe this is it. It makes sense. And here we are again in the Silent Depression, as I like to call it, since 2007. Capitalism certainly has failed. It's reached a cul-de-sac. And the people that believe that
this is in the eyes of the Marxist. I want to be clear.
Well, I think capitalism has failed as well. We've reached a cul-de-sac. Now we need to back out and go in another direction. I don't say throw the baby out with the bathwater and give up on capitalism, but the Marxists say, look, this happened. It's over. We're not generating any more wealth for the last 14 years. It's all financialization going to the uber wealthy. And it looks like it makes sense. The economy has stagnated. It's the worst 14 years that we've experienced since the Great Depression. I maintain it was actually worse than in year 14 of the Great Depression. And so in China, that's exactly what happened. They pursued a model that Michael Pettis, the China expert, often calls the Alexander Gershonkin model. I mispronounced it, but basically it's a model, a growth model that many, many, many countries have pursued, which is to do exactly what you said, is increase the pool of savings, use it to subsidize exports, manufacturing, grow the economy, and then eventually you get to a point where it stops working. That model always stops working. And it coincided with another worldwide depression, the Silent Depression. And so Xi Jinping, a good Marxist that he is, good Chinese communist characteristics, he says, yeah, it's time to stop the belief that we can continue growing as we did before 2007. It's time to accept a slower pace of growth and to redistribute power, just as it was predicted, that end stage capitalism is here.
So you think that's what he's doing with his more authoritarian approach to public or private companies like in the tech sector, and then maybe even his approach with Evergrande? I mean, it looks like he's being more capitalist, allowing Schumpeter's creative destruction to take hold and just allowing them to fail, something I think we should have done here in the United States if we had true capitalism back in during the GFC. But so a lot of people look at that and say, oh my gosh, he's being more capitalist than the United States. But maybe in reality, his true motive is that he's not trying to move more towards capitalism. He's trying to move more towards this socialist workers' utopia by showing the capitalists that he is in charge, and the government is going to start having more control and potentially even taking over the means of production.
I would be very surprised if he let Evergrande go, if Evergrande was one of the inner circle, right? No, right. I am assuming that this is an alternative power center to Beijing, to his power source, and that's why he's letting it go. That's what I would expect. He doesn't seem like someone, no, all his announcements, the 19th Party Congress at the end of 2017, it's all been repeating the notion that we have, that we're not going to reach that fantastic goal of a prosperous society. Now it's a moderately prosperous society, and we're de-emphasizing the prosperity and we're emphasizing common prosperity. So definitely he's not pursuing capitalism. He's pursuing power politics, and he knows what a precarious situation China is, both internally and externally. This is no time to have alternative power sources inside the walls. When you're confronting what may be a second Cold War, we just had that Quad meeting with the four Pacific powers and the agreement between the United States, Australia, and the United Kingdom. The world looks tough for China on the outside. It looks tough on the inside, and you can't have alternative power sources on the inside. You've got to have one emperor leading the way. What's going to be a very difficult adjustment period. Earlier, I mentioned that model. The way the model ends is you either go through quite a long period of digesting all the inefficiencies, let's call it a lost decade or so, or you go through a financial crisis, a destabilizing, rapid rebalancing of all the imbalances inside. And I would assume that's not what they want. So they want to have a slow grind, a little bit like what we saw in Brazil in the 80s and the Japanese right now. By the way, I keep forgetting to mention, I love that Richard Werner episode that you did. And everyone who's listening to this, they've got to go listen to that. It was fantastic.
Thank you. Yeah, Richard's a great guy. We actually talked a little bit after the recording, and I think I'm pretty confident that we'll be doing that in the very near future.
Awesome.
So, yeah, and when what you're talking about as far as this decline in economic output, or in essence, the standard of living in China, it's a whole different ballgame there when you are dealing with social unrest with a billion people compared to, let's say, Australia right now with 25 million. You know, you've got the same or similar size government trying to manage a billion people. And that gets ugly, or that could get ugly very quickly. And when I look at global macro, I say, okay, if that's the direction they're potentially going, that means that they are going to be producing fewer goods, and they're going to be importing fewer goods. I did a research for a whiteboard video last week where I read they import about $2 trillion worth of goods annually. We just think of them as a huge exporter, but they import a lot as well because of the size of their economy. And assuming that 50% of those transactions are settled in dollars, well, if their imports go down by half because you have this decline in an economic superpower, it because they're being taken over by a communist regime. And although they think that may lead to a socialist utopia, we all know where that leads. And that leads into this nightmare totalitarian police state, which is very inefficient at producing goods and services. Look at North Korea as an example. And therefore, they're importing a lot less. Therefore, they're exporting a lot fewer dollars. And, you know, what does that do to the euro dollar system? And what does that do to global liquidity if that puts the squeeze on global dollar cash flows and their ability to pay back that debt? If those debts default, it's true that money doesn't get destroyed, but it reduces the balance sheet capacity for those banks in the euro dollar system to provide liquidity to all those global corporations that need it to survive. And to me, that leads to one place, and that's a global Lehman Brothers moment. I don't know.
Yes, all of what you said, agreed. Here's an interesting little fact. During the Deng Xiaoping and et cetera expansion, what we saw is foreign capital coming into China in the form of foreign direct investment, meaning you're buying the controlling interest of a company and you're investing in things that can't be moved very easily, plant, property, equipment, employees, real stuff. We have seen since 2014 that switch, and it is now dominated by portfolio inflows. That's what's dominating China. And I bring this up because we saw this in the Asian financial crisis. Same thing, the Southeast Asian and the four Asian, the tigers. Right. We saw FDI at first and then portfolio flows. And you know how portfolio flows, hot money flows are, how skittish they are. They're a coward. Capital is a coward. And we've seen some things out of China that are not reassuring, let's say. If these portfolio flows start leaving China, it would be destabilizing. Quite destabilizing, because now they're the dominant inflow for a country that's desperate for dollars. And so what's going to happen? It's unsettling. They may put down the gates. They may not let those flows leave. To your larger point, the future is not one where China is leading and growing economically and vigorously. And that's going to have a negative effect on the economy. Sure, global economy.
All right, my friend, we'll leave it there. In the sake of time, for my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, the podcast, where do they go?
You can go to three places, eurodollarenterprises.com. That's where you can find out what show came out, where the podcasts are, David Parkin's artwork, as well as the satirical lampooning commercials that I like to do. Place number two, YouTube. So you can see the interviews that I do as well as the latest macro piece theater readings that I do. Tomorrow's reading, episode 112, will be Lynn Alden's August newsletter.
Oh, wow. That's going to be fantastic. Anything now, Lynn is fantastic.
Fantastic. And I reached out to her. So I don't want anyone to think I'm just reading it out loud. I said, Lynn, do you think this is the worst idea you've heard today? And Lynn said, you know what? It's the late afternoon. So no, it's not the worst idea I've heard today so far. Let's do it. So the YouTube channel is where you can see all that. And then
what's
last
the name
place
of the YouTube channel, Emil?
Emil Kalinowski.
Okay. Okay.
And then the last place is the Twitter. On the tweets, in the Twitter, at Emil Kalinowski. And I appreciate it, George, and congratulations to you on your success and the important work that you're doing. I was really moved about 2 weeks ago on your Q&A session on a Sunday. It was very powerful, very moving. I think you're doing important work about, you know, we're heading into a fourth turning, but that doesn't mean we have to go willingly and accept all the totalitarian, overwhelming tendencies that are necessary during these kind of moments in history. You know, we need to speak up, and you are. And courage is the rarest of human characteristics, and what you're doing is courageous. So I want to applaud you on behalf of many people in the audience who may not have the chance to do that. So continue to good work.
Well, thank you very much, Emil. And I'm definitely going to continue to stand up and fight for freedom. There are a lot of people in the world today that recognize that the path we're on leads to a very dark place. So collectively, as a group of people who value freedom, I think that we can really move the needle. That's what I'm going to continue to do on my channel. And I appreciate the support of everyone in the community and with you and Jeff. And, you know, let's just keep educating people and opening up their eyes.
If the quarantine rules over here in the Cayman Islands relax, I will be in Houston for the Rebel Capitalist Live 2 extravaganza. So I hope to see you there in person.
Well, email me that because you'll be a VIP guest. So when I bring VIP guests in, there's a little bit different treatment there, and I'd be happy to extend that to you. So make sure you tweet me if you can do it, and then I'll get in touch with my assistant and she'll hook it up.
I have extravagant demands, George, so don't think, you know, all right? We'll see.
Only yellow M&Ms, right, Emil?
George, I know we've been going long, but do you know that story? Do you know where it comes from?
It's Mariah Carey, isn't it?
I think it was some big rock band.
Yeah, I think it was Mariah
Which
Carey.
Rock band, it's not important. But the point is, George, the reason they did it is because they toured all over the world and they put on huge productions on a huge stage and set. And so they're meeting different people at different stadiums. They don't know how efficient these people are. So they put together a list and they said,
that was a test. I never knew that. Okay.
This, and this, and we want brown M&Ms. And if they got to their room and there were brown M&Ms in the bowl, they knew everything had been followed to the letter of the law. It was going to be a good show. And if it wasn't.
I learned something new today, Emil. Thank you very much.
Maybe in the comments section, people can tell us which band it was. I think it was Van Halen,
or was
it? You know, 1980s big hair band, or 70s. I forgot.
All right. Well, enjoy the rest of your day, my friend. Hopefully we see you in Houston.
Hi, guys. I'd like to invite each and every one of you to the next Rebel Capitalist Live event. If you are a fan of the Rebel Capitalist show, I guarantee you will love the live event. The next one is Houston, where you can meet and listen to speakers, all your favorites from the Rebel Capitalist show. People such as Dr. Ron Paul, Chris Cole, Lynn Alden, just to name a few. If you want to check out the rest of the speaker list and find out how you can attend, we'll put a link in the description below, or you can just go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. This is an event where you can learn to build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. But it's not just about building wealth. It's about increasing your freedom and networking with like-minded individuals, fellow rebel capitalists. It's an amazing event. I know you'll absolutely love it. Check out rebelcapitalistlive.com, and I will see you in Houston.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.